nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so we're just going to pick up where we left off. Before I begin, if you have a sketch of your of the project you want to submit, I'd be very happy to receive it. I already spoke to all of you, but I think it's more for yourselves than for me to see what idea you've outlined for yourself. Okay, so you can turn that in at the end of class. All right, so we left off here on Tuesday, and we were talking about the plasmon resonance bands, right, that are associated with silver and gold particles. And one thing that we've noted is that as the particle size changes, say from starting around 20 nanometers and going on to larger, is that you get both a shift in the position of the peak as well as the breadth of the peak. Okay, and these are attributed to physical changes in the particle with respect to the path length of the electrons. Okay, and so usually when we talk about nanoparticles and their or metal particles and their plasmon resonances, we're thinking about the dipolar mode, right? So if you go from one pole to the other, one end of the particle to the other, you can generate a resonance this way. But as a particle gets larger, you get other possible pathways. And also the distance to go from one side to the other becomes longer. And this has, creates what we call phase retardation. Okay. So I think that really the parts important for us to remember is that as you change the physical size of the particle, right, you can change the position of the resonance, right, and this will result in either a change in absorption or in scattering. Okay. For today, what we're going to pay attention to more is that as we change the size of the particle, we actually are also increasing the scattering cross section. Okay, so the larger the particle, the more reflective, the more it's easier it is become to detect because of a size dependent scattering term. Let's look a little bit more closely at this size dependency. So, in addition to the size of the particle, the environment that it's in is also important. So, if you remember that equation that we talked about on Tuesday, this is the Drude model, right? There are two factors that really dictate the particle resonance, right, in addition to the material property. So one is the size. So we just take a look at one of these curves, right? This really tells you more or less what the position. So let's just start down here from 10 nanometers, right, up to, 40 to 50 nanometers. You can see that there's a change in the position of the wavelength. If we use the numbers down here from, say, 387 nanometers to over here to 413 nanometers and forward, okay? But notice also that depending on the dielectric that the particle is placed, you can also affect its wavelength. So here, this curve represents the particle is just in vacuum or air, okay? So just starting from down here, this is about 364 nanometers, okay? But if the particle is taken from there and embedded into glass, right, then this position changes from 364 to 387, and then if you transfer to a higher dielectric constant material, such as titanium dioxide, then you can get yet further shift in this, okay? And this is maybe more familiar to us as chemists if we think about this in solvents, right, where the solvent dielectric constant changes. And this is typically termed a solvatochromic effect, okay? So if you were to change from, say, a solvent like hexanes, right, to decalin, to carbon disulfide, you can change the solvent refractive index. And this is a very similar phenomenon, okay? So here in this particular case, and I'm sorry the colors aren't cooperating today because you can't, the yellow's really mixed in here. But as you change from a low dielectric constant, say, water, this is water here, to hexane, right? And then going up along this curve to a higher dielectric constant, you're also changing the position of the surface plasmon band, okay? So whether you're in a solid material or in a liquid material, right, the refractive index or dielectric constant, which are related just simply by a square root sign, right, will cause the position of the peak to change. Okay, and so this is actually these are gold nanoparticles suspended in different solvents. They're coated with some polymer to keep them stabilized in solution. But this is gold nanoparticles in water, these are gold nanoparticles and carbon disulfide. The numbers are on top are the dielectric constant, the refractive index of those particular solvents. Okay, and this turns out to be a very important phenomenon for later on today, because not only is the environment of the particle important, but actually just in a very local sense, changes on the surface of the particle can also cause the color of the particles to change. Okay, and again, today the projector isn't doing this justice, so you can't see it as well as you can as I can on my screen over here. All right, so really this is too bad. All right, well, at least we can see green, red and green here, so this is going to work out partially. Let's put this in terms of some applications, okay? And many of the applications I'm going to talk about today are actually biologically related, okay? And of course, up to now, we've been avoiding talking too much about biology, but I should say that metal nanoparticles, gold in particular, is really compatible with biological systems, okay? But you can easily translate this to chemical or supermolecular systems. So in that sense, these are universal phenomena. But biological systems, particularly those involving DNA, have been kind of like the cookies and cream of nanotechnology, right? The gold particles, you know, really provide the very nice detection sensitivity, and the DNA detection has been one of the areas that people have been highly interested in. Okay, so let's just build on some of the physical principles that we've talked about. Okay, so we were talking about how size is important in terms of changing the scattering properties. The bigger the particle gets, the larger the scattering cross-section becomes, so it's easier to detect. And so here's a very easy way that people have determined to changing the optical cross-section of the particle. Okay, so this is a DNA-coated chip, right? You're going to see this a lot today, DNA strand detection has been of great importance ever since the human genome had been decoded, and people have been wanting to look at short oligomeric sequences that correspond to gene products. And so this idea is really taken off in the biotechnology sector. So how does one detect DNA sequences? Okay, so one of the strategies that has been proposed and established is that if you have a particular sequence, right, that's half of the sequence is on a surface, and the other half of the sequence is attached to a gold particle, you can detect the complementary strand, often called the antisense strand, right, which will couple the gold particle to the surface. Okay, so this complementary strand is what you're detecting, right? If you have a good match, the perfect match between the nucleotides, then you'll get the gold particles to be tethered in proximity to the complementary half over here. Okay, so we're going to assume for now that this is a perfect match. Okay, if you have a perfect match, you have a very tight binding. If you have a mismatch, say in this case, if X were anything other than A, then the binding is not as tight, and you can just heat this up slightly, and you can get these strands to dehybridize. Right, but for right now, we're just going to focus on the fact that if you do have a good sequence strand specificity, then you can get the gold particles to be localized by according to the address of the DNA label. Okay? And I don't think that's very hard to imagine. Now, a gold particle by itself, although we've talked about how large the extinction coefficient is, right, 10 to the 9th, 10 to the 10th, and so on, still it's kind of hard to see single gold particles without specialized equipment. So one of the very easy ways to increase the detectability of gold is just simply to make it larger. Okay? So a very old strategy, long before nanotechnology became a hot topic, was if you have colloidal gold on the presence of some surface, you can enlarge it simply by introducing in some silver ion under reducing conditions. Okay, so by introducing hydroquinone, which is a mild reducing agent, and silver monocation, you can deposit silver, right? Seed the growth of silver around gold, and this effectively creates a larger metal particle. And so now what happens here is that this follows the trend that we were just discussing, right? That as you get to larger size particles, right, you can shift this, the wavelength, but also you're going to be increasing the optical cross-section. So both the scattering and the absorption goes up by large amounts. Okay. And I think it's easiest to appreciate just by looking at it over here. Okay. So here's a case where if we took, you know, 10 nanomolar concentration of gold particle containing the DNA label, right? Here's what the plate looks like after soaking, saturating the surface with it. And it takes on a light pink color, or at least it should be light pink. Okay. And that corresponds to the plasma resonance of this, small gold particle, about 15 nanometers or so. But if you do the silver staining, right, this 15 nanometer particle grows into 100 or even 200 nanometers. And now, of course, you get a much, much stronger extinction of light from this position. Okay. So this is just simply an optical amplification based on the scattering properties of metal particles. Very, very easy and simple to do. Okay. This one actually tells it even better, right? So here in this case, this slide E has even smaller concentration of gold particles. It's 100 picomolar, but it's really not detectable to our eye, to the naked eye. If you use the special microscope, you can see them. But to our naked eye, the tint simply isn't strong enough. But still the seeds are there. If you introduce in the silver growth solution, right, then of course you can get the color to develop. Okay. So if you're thinking that this is fancy technology, or you're skeptical this is fancy technology, well, you're right, right? This is actually, you know, 19th century or the turn of the 20th century technology back in the days when people were developing photographs, right? They're doing very similar things by adding silver salts and simply darkening these, right, in the presence of light and other kind of driving forces, okay? But this is a reinvention of something that that people have known for a long time. But now we actually understand it in the context of the physical property. What's really happening is that by throwing in a small gold seed that has, you know, strong but still relatively modest optical properties, you can amplify this greatly by just simply making it larger. Okay? And they were able to use this in the context of DNA detection. And so what they found is that if you have a 12 base pair strand, right, you can detect this at concentrations on the order of 100 picomolar. But if you have an 18 base pair strand where you have much more pairing, the hybridization is stronger, you can get a much greater affinity of the gold, and you can get down to actually the femtomolar range in terms of the detection. So just a really simple idea, but applied in a very powerful way to a modern day concept. Okay. So if you haven't guessed, this is a work that was came out of the lab of Chad Merkin, Northwestern, right? He was the one who really popularized the idea of using colloidal gold particles for DNA detection. So this is one of several easy examples to appreciate. Okay, so this is just as easy to appreciate. Okay, so it's just looking at it from a different angle, so to speak. And so in this case, we're not changing the size of the particle, but rather using different size particles as different colorimetric labels. Okay, so here are these gold particles. So we've already mentioned that if you have gold particles that are relatively small, 50 nanometers or less, right, their wavelength of absorption or scattering is going to be in 520 to 530 nanometers. And this corresponds to the green region of the visible wavelength. Okay. Now, if you use an 80 nanometer particle, right, this has been shifted. Okay, so this corresponds to yellow, which, like the screen. And if we have even larger particles, say 100 nanometers or so, then you get a further shift, and now this gets into the orange range, right? And it's very easy for our eyes to detect the difference between green, yellow, and orange. Okay, and so in this case, you have labels of two different size particles, two different kind of DNA strands, and so of course their localization is encoded by the complementarity to the other strand, followed by the detection strand, right, that will be the complement to both A and C. And so when they're bound, you can now image the particles under dark field scattering conditions. Okay, and this is just a fancy way of saying that if you shine light in from the side, right, you can get only scattering from the brightest objects on the slide. Okay, so here these are the 50 nanometer gold particles, right, that are scattering green light. Okay, and these are the 80 nanometer particles scattering orange light. Okay, and their positions are localized simply by force of the biomolecular recognition of DNA. Okay, so again, very easy application of the basic property of a size-dependent plasmon resonance. It's changing the size of the particle, changes the scattering wavelength, right? It also changes the overall absorption or extinction intensity, right? As you saw in the previous example, right? So simple, right? But still really very powerful and relatively inexpensive, right? For an important application. Okay, so you can start to combine these ideas, and there's you know lots of interesting variations on the theme. And I think that by going through multiple examples, you really start to get a sense of what becomes possible when working with these metal colloidal particles. So what if we took particles that had various functional groups? It could be any one of these three: DNA, protein, or antibody to a protein. And if you introduced in the corresponding recognition element, perhaps something that's multivalent, then you can get particles to dimerize or to aggregate into clusters. Okay, and so what happens then? So what you're effectively doing if you induce an aggregation based on some molecular recognition is that you've effectively again created a larger particle. Okay, so that means then the particle should behave, or I should say this aggregate should behave effectively like a single large particle. The scattering cross-section increases, okay? The wavelength of the plasmon also shifts in the same way that a single large particle would shift, okay? They're not exactly the same, of course, and you'll see differences in a little bit, but you can think about this as another way of amplifying the optical properties of these metal particles. Okay, so if you just can get them to aggregate in a controlled fashion, you can actually enhance their scattering cross-section, making them easier to detect. Okay, so so you don't actually need to grow them in a chemical sense. You can actually just get particles to aggregate. The trick, of course, is to get them to aggregate in a way that is controlled, right? If everything aggregates together, that might lead to difficulties in reproducing the optical behaviors. Okay, but the principle is pretty clean. Okay, so light scattering, if you haven't guessed by now, is probably one of the favorite techniques that people use for detecting low concentrations of molecules in solution. Okay, and because gold and silver are both so sensitive are so good at enhancing the detection light detection, they're the ones that are employed all the time. Okay, now we can, of course, rely on the wavelength, but you can even use light scattering to detect subtle changes in size. So if you get involved in anything that involves particles, one of the routine methods of characterization is a technique known as dynamic light scattering. Okay, so you're actually able to characterize the size of the particle based on the optical output that it gives. Okay, and so this is as particles get larger, as anything gets larger, their motion starts to slow down. Okay, the rates of diffusion become less and less. Just according to some very simple laws of diffusion, and so the rate at which they diffuse through solution, right, corresponds to their effective hydrodynamic diameter. Okay, and so this change also is quite easy to pick up because, again, the scattering is so bright from these particles. So it's very easy to measure their sizes based on this hydrodynamic, this dynamic light scattering process. Okay, so this also has been translated into a way to detect molecules. So if you, again, start with a DNA-coated gold particle, right, maybe the average size is 35 nanometers, and as soon as you add in some small amount of reagent, right, say 5 picomolar of the complementary DNA strand, the particles start to aggregate together, like in this drawing here, and the dynamic light scattering can detect that by giving you an increase in the size. So even just sensing the rate of diffusion of particle can be used as an analytical tool by people. And then, the larger the aggregate comes by introducing more analyte, right, the larger the effective size becomes. So there are lots of different ways to play this game. You can watch the optics. You can watch the extinction position, right, by scattering, right. You can watch the scattering intensity. You can even watch the effective size of the particles. Okay, but I think perhaps the most popular way and maybe the easiest way to appreciate the optical properties of metal particles is to watch the wavelength shift when these particles aggregate. OK, Okay, so again, this is, in a sense, is a size-dependent phenomenon, right? As the particle gets larger, we saw how the wavelength shift. There's a bit more to it than that, though, and we'll get into the details of that in a few minutes. But I think right now, this slide is really very easy to appreciate. If you were to simply take gold particles into dispersant solution, right, and we've seen these to be a red solution, and you have that complementary biomolecular component, and you cause them to aggregate, the particles get together, and not only are they effectively larger, but the plasmons then become coupled, right? And the coupling of plasmons also causes a shift, right? So the plasmons are just very sensitive to all sorts of changes in their environment. But the thing that they're most sensitive to is each other, okay? If you have two particles with, more or less independent plasmons, and they are now fixed within close proximity, see, less than one particle diameter, their plasmons then become coupled, and you now get a more complex system, which causes this shift to longer wavelength. And for us, this is very easy to detect, right? So for free-floating particles, these are red, but if you have an aggregated set of particles, the shift goes to blue. And so this has been turned into a very easy-to-appreciate spot test, right? When you have sufficient amounts of reagent to cause the aggregation, again, typically in the picomolar concentration or even less, you can just simply appreciate the change by watching the color change from red to blue. Okay, and so this is exactly what's been done here. So for each one of these cases, right, they show, right, what happens if you have the complementary target, right, versus no target, right? Complementary target, you have blue, no target, it's red. And then if you now start to dial in, right, the sensitivity of DNA recognition, right, if you have, let's say, let's see how big this strand is here. So if you have, 10 or 12 base pairs here, but you have something like a one pair base pair mismatch, right? And you look at the concentration, you look at these colors here, you can have an aggregate, right, that remains stable up to about 42 degrees, but as soon as you get past about 50 degrees, this aggregate melts, right? And the particles will revert back to their individual states, okay? If you have more than a base pair mismatch, so two base pair mismatch, right? Again, you can get an aggregation room temperature, but now your melting temperature is even lower, right? And that's really reflective of the strength of the affinity between compared DNA DNA strands. Okay, so this is a reversible process, clearly, because you have thermodynamics working to dissociate the particles as well as to, of course, cause them to aggregate for enthalpic reasons. Okay, so this, of course, has been the most popular way to be able to detect changes of anything in solution. If you just simply bring in an analyte, whatever it is, molecule, DNA, protein, right, or something small, and you can cause particles to aggregate, right, the first thing you detect is a change in color because the plasmons of the particles will be coupled by their close proximity to each other. Okay, so there are really lots of different ways to play the game, right? The question that you'll encounter later, right, after spring break, when it's time to do some more homework exercises, is just really being able to tease out why a wavelength change. What are the causes for wavelength shifts to occur and for scattering cross sections to change? Okay, so they'll all boil down to very similar reasons, but the variations are the details of that cause differences between them. Okay. Do you have any questions about these? So if you were to design a system based on the optical properties of gold or silver particles, right, you can be sure, right, that all you need to do is get them together or to, change anything about their physical parameters, and you'll be able to detect that. Okay.
Just, this might be a really simple question. Did anyone try, apart from gold and silver, any other metal is, in this aspect, why these are special, towards this activity?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the question is, why gold and silver? And it really goes back to the beginning of our discussion here about, right, what a plasmon is, okay, and what supports plasmon. So in principle, any metal particle will support a plasmon, right? This conductive excitation of this collective excitation of conduction electrons. Okay? The reason that it's gold or silver has to do with, well, I'm sorry, it was one slide too fast. Has to do with the fact that this is a complex dielectric function. There is a real term and an imaginary term. Okay, all metals will have a real term that can become negative, which leads to a potential plasma resonance. But not all metals have a small imaginary component, which is important for getting a strong resonance to begin with. So take, for example, copper, right, which is the closest in terms of a noble metal like gold or silver, right? And this curve tells us something about how strong the imaginary component is. So just look at these numbers here. This is a measure of something known as the optical conductivity. And you can see that the values for copper are in the range of, you know, well above 10 for most of the visible range. Whereas in case of silver, right, it's very low. Okay. Gold, it's not so great, but it drops down, at least it starts to drop down past 550 nanometers. So we do get plasma resonances, right, starting in the mid 500s. Okay. But for copper, we don't get a chance to do that until past 700. By that time, it's actually a little bit too late. We don't really get much of the real component is already rather negative. So you miss the resonance peak that's provided by the Clausius-Zeldin equation. Okay. So to be able to get, right, this condition here, the resonance condition matched with a very small imaginary component, there's few metals that meet the bill. Okay. So it turns out that there are a couple of other metals now being looked at depending on what wavelengths you're interested in. If you want to go well outside the visible, people have been looking at aluminum, for example. So that becomes very interesting when you're looking at longer wavelengths or shorter wavelengths. Sodium metal, right? Sodium and lithium are actually very good plasmonic materials. But the problem with sodium and lithium is that they're rather air sensitive, right? So can't work with those. So practically speaking, silver and gold would be the two most likely candidates, right, for a chemistry-related application. Okay, so I hope that answers the question. Okay, you could use other metals, but only gold and silver have the practical reason because of this optical conductivity issue, the imaginary component of their dielectric function. So now this is really just variations on a theme. Okay, and so maybe by now you're sick of hearing about DNA detection, and would like to see some other applications. So here's another case. This one's actually the detection of sugars, and this one involves a protein known as lectins. Lectins are carbohydrate binding structures, and so in this case, the gold particles have sugar molecules tethered on the outside. So initially there's a thiolated ligand with an aldehyde terminal group, and then you can do a conjugation to different kind of sugars, lactose or mannose type derivatives, and the terminal end of these sugars then can be recognized by different kind of proteins, right? So this one, known as RCA120, can induce the nanoparticles to aggregate the same way that complementary DNA strands or antisense strands cause the DNA-coated gold particles to aggregate. And that corresponds, again, to, of course, a color change. And you can see this optically, right, in the spectrum over here. So this dark curve corresponds to gold particles that are coated with sugars, but no proteins around. And as you increase the concentration of the protein, the lectin, right, you can see how the curve changes, okay? So by the time you get down to D and E, you have a big shoulder, right here around 600 to 700 nanometer, and that gives you the overall impression of a purple tint in solution, okay? So even though we don't really need to be quantitative about the spectral changes, right, we can easily detect with our own eyes, right, the change in the optical properties. So this is really, again, made this a favorite for chemists and biologists, right, because there is no need to do a quantitative measurement, right? You can just tell by looking. Okay, there are hundreds of examples of this sort of aggregation-induced optical changes. Okay, and so I'm going to stop here with those examples. If you want to learn more about that and see how this has been applied to supramolecular chemistry, there's a very nice book chapter in this book here, Inorganic Nanoprobes for Biological sensing and imaging, and so you can see, you know, some 50 different variations of this sort of theme in that book. Okay, so what I'm going to do for the rest of today is to start to introduce in some other analytical tools, right, that take advantage of the optical properties of gold particles. And so far we've just been relying on our eyes to do the detection. I mean, that's the easiest. But we can actually, if we incorporate analytical instrumentation, detect down to the single particle limit. Okay, and if you have only one molecule associated per particle, well, then effectively you can detect down to single molecule limit, right? And that's a pretty exciting regime to be in. I hope to be able to talk about single molecule chemistry sometime later this semester. But first, let's look at some of these tools. Okay, so there is a technique that is known as surface plasmon resonance, which sounds a lot like what we were just talking about in terms of gold particle. And this is an important technique to discuss, not only because it's useful, but I want to distinguish this from the localized surface plasmon resonance associated with gold particles. Okay, so let me tell you what SPR in the bulk sense means. Okay, so this is really considered to be a bulk property of a gold film, as opposed to the property of a nanoparticle film. They are, of course, related, okay, but for now, I think it's easier to talk to them as if they're separate entities. Okay, so the way that SPR works is that you have some kind of gold-coated glass slide. Okay, so this bottom part is gold, and then on the top part is glass. Well, actually, in this case, they actually have a glass prism. Okay, and they have light coming through here, and it's bouncing at a very specific angle. Okay, and what had been determined a few years before gold particles really hit the big time is that if you shine the light at a very specific angle, you can get what is known as an anomalous reflectance dip. Okay, and so this will just refer to as being a critical angle, and because there is a certain coupling, right, between the incident light and how the plasmas that propagate through the gold film, right, are coupled, you can actually, by changing the angle, go from a completely reflective state to a non-reflective state. And so this axis here is the angle which you tilt the beam, right? And so when you tilt it at just the right angle, right, then suddenly your reflectance just drops to almost zero, okay? And then just a little bit of a change further, then the reflectance comes back, and then it's as if you never encountered this strange dip, okay? And it was a very strange phenomenon for many people the first encounter, but somebody finally got the good idea that this could actually be very useful because, again, like gold particles, this angle-dependent dip is quite sensitive to its environment. So what was determined is that if you change the chemistry on the other side of the gold surface, because it's a very thin gold layer, it's only about 50 nanometers thick, you can change the dielectric properties of gold, okay? Which is the same thing that we've been doing with the gold particles, but now we're doing with the gold film. Okay, so the current practical application for this is that if you coat this with some recognition element, typically antibodies, or some kind of protein, and some molecules bind to the surface, maybe a second type of protein, you change the local dielectric around the surface. Okay, so it's as if you're changing refractive index, but of course with on the length scale of molecules. And so this local change is the same as the changes that we've been seeing with the gold particles by putting them in different solvents. Instead of causing a wavelength shift, though, you cause a change in the angle, the critical angle of which this dips. So what people do is that they don't actually change the angle all the time. They don't do that sweeping because that's kind of difficult to do. What they do is they fix the angle at this position, okay? And if something absorbs to the surface and causes this curve to shift, what they'll see instead is actually an increase in the overall reflective intensity because you're no longer on resonance, right? So if this curve shifts enough and you're always sitting at this angle, what you'll be seeing is no signal to very strong signal. Okay, and that's actually very easy to detect, right? It's a positive signal control. So this is what you actually measure, right? So if you're at that fixed critical angle when nothing is binding to the surface, and then things start to attach onto the surface, what you see is from a non-reflective condition, which is resonance, right? to a reflective condition, which is off resonance. It's very simple. Okay? And this is the rate at which this change occurs is very much in line with everything we understand about the kinetics of adsorption and desorption, right? So this follows, this just follows a physical chemistry to a T. And so people have been able to measure all sorts of kinetic information about the binding of molecules or proteins to things that are adsorbed on the surface. Okay, so it's been a terrifically useful tool, especially for biochemists who want to know something about protein-protein interactions. Now, there's a limit to this method. It's very nice, especially if you're a biochemist, but it works best for proteins because proteins are actually fairly large and they're also usually charged. Okay, and if there's anything that's going to modulate a dielectric constant, charge will have one of the greatest roles in doing so. So if you're going to modulate the charge on the surface, you're going to change the local environment by a lot. Okay, and so measuring a protein adsorption onto the surface is easy to do by SPR. But measuring the adsorption of small molecules, you know, let's just say gas molecules like CO2, is really hard to do. Okay, so even though the gas molecule may itself have a difference in a dielectric function in its bulk property, if you only have a monolayer of molecules on the surface, that doesn't really cause an overall change in the effective dielectric at the surface. Okay, so you need to have a lot of material, protein would be in this case considered a lot of material, to cause a significant change in the shift of the surface plasmon angle. Okay, so chemists are kind of left out in the cold when it comes to SPR. If you're looking for a small molecule detection, this is not the best method. But there are ways to increase this. Okay, and so one way that you can use to increase this is to attach your analyte molecule, or at least attach part of your detection system onto the metal particle. So if there's anything that changes the local surface dielectric more than a charged protein, it's a metal particle, because the metal particle has many conduction electrons on it. And just as we've seen already with metal particles coming together and causing a plasma resonance to couple, a metal particle getting close to a metal surface will also cause that same kind of coupling. Okay. Now, in this case, we don't look for a color change. What we are doing is basically enhancing, amplifying the shift at which this critical angle changes. So by attaching a gold particle onto some molecule of interest, you can cause these shifts in angles that are much larger. So from A to B, right, for example, right, this is what happens if you are only looking at the molecule binding to the surface. It's a very small change. This is detectable, but it's a small change, right? But if you attach a nanoparticle to it, then you have A to C, right? And that's a huge change. If you're just stuck at this angle, you can see that your percent reflectance goes from, say, 5% up to about 60%. Whereas if you're just looking at, you know, the DNA component by itself, right, the change in reflectance is maybe on the order of 1% if you're lucky. Okay, so this can greatly amplify, right, changes in the surface plasma resonance of a bulk film, as well as changing particle resonances between each other. Okay, so the gold particle, I guess you can think of as a very polarizable element, right? You know, just really turbo boosts any kind of electronic interactions between structures, whether it's between another nanoparticle or between a metal particle, a metal surface. Okay, now, taking this one step further, right, so people will recognize, okay, so you can bring gold particles here, but still, right, you know, that's, can we do better? And so somebody got the clever idea that you don't really need a metal surface at all, right? Why not just use metal particles themselves to sense changes in refractive index? Okay, so, you know, instead of having to worry about where the critical angle shifts, let's directly measure the shift of the plasma resonance of nanoparticles themselves. And so a guy at Northwestern is just chock full of people who work with metal particles, but this fellow is an analytical chemist named Richard Van Dyne, came up with, another very clever idea, where he was able to create these triangular prism-shaped particles on the surfaces. The fabrication is actually itself very interesting. What he does is that he takes silica spheres or latex spheres and gets them to assemble on the surface as a monolayer. So he gets these hexagonally closed packed spheres. And then he evaporates gold onto it. And the gaps between the spheres, right, then become these triangles. And then he washes away the spheres, and this is what he's left with. Okay, so this is really the spheres that pack together on the surface acts as a mask, a colloidal mask, and you're left behind these triangular particles whose sizes are controlled pretty much by the size of the particles that you use to create the gaps in the first place. And the heights of the particles, of course, are controlled by the rate of evaporation. So it's a very nice top-down method to create nanostructures. And so he's able to create these triangular-shaped particles on the order of 100 nanometers, but he can change the dimensions in one direction or another simply by changing the template and the rate of evaporation. Okay, so for all intents and purposes, these two are gold or silver particles, which just happen to not be spherical. They're anisotropic. They have a special shape to them. And so these particular triangular silver particles have a starting resonance around 560 nanometers, okay, as opposed to about 400 nanometers for a spherical particle. Okay, but if you just stay with me for a while, this particle, each one of these particles, when they're coated with something as small as just an alkane thiol, you can see actually a very significant shift, right, in the plasma resonance by something on the order of 30, almost 40 nanometers in direction. Okay, this is not an angle shift now. This is literally the plasma resonance shift itself. Okay, so what's happening here? Right, what's happening is that in this case, the gold particle, silver particles, are much more sensitive to their changes in the surface dielectric than that flat gold film. Okay, the flat gold film, right, can sense the change, but the shifts are very mild, at least by the method that we just saw. Here, by looking at the localized surface plasma resonance, right, that turns out to be much more sensitive to changes in chemical environment. Okay, so just a monolayer of alkene thiols is enough to cause more than a 30 nanometer shift in the resonance. Okay, and if you look at B versus C, right, B versus C is the difference between, say, a simple alkane thiol versus a alkene thiol that has, say, a biotin molecule on it. Even this kind of change can lead to something that's detectable, right? And again, we're still just talking about molecular level thickness of film. Okay. And finally, if you now, you know, biotin, of course, is famous for binding a protein known as streptavidin, right? If you have streptavidin binding on here, again, you can get another sizable shift on the order of 20 nanometers or so, right? So whatever is happening at the surface, right, one, two, three events, right, we can detect all those changes with a nanoparticle prism film versus an extended gold film. Okay, so this turns out to be really easy to do, right? All we need to do is basically take a spectrometer and modify it so that you can flow things across the surface and watch for changes in the signal in the maximum of the resonances. As long as you have a nice sharp resonance, right? That's the only thing you really need. You can easily watch the shift in the peak. So this is in fact exactly what these people have been doing for the following 10 years, is just be able to measure changes in concentration, right, in real time, just by measuring exactly where the peak position is. So this is, by most people's estimation, quite the advance over this standard SPR approach. So it's a good example of where nano really beats the pants off of, you know, the bulk scale materials. And even so, right, this is not really a bulk material. It's 50 nanometers across. It's just that, right, the plasmons are not localized in a way that we have with the triangular particles. Okay, so nanoparticles, again, makes the grade in terms of changing in terms of sensitivity to an optical property. Okay, can we further improve on this? And the answer is certainly yes. In fact, there continues to be improvements, right? And this has to do now not so much with making smaller particles, but to make particles that deviate strongly from being spherical. Okay, so I've introduced to you this prism-shaped particle, okay, and there was a very nice study done by the same group where they made particles with different shapes. In fact, it was just simply a random synthesis, and they were able to isolate or identify particles that were spheres, some particles are triangular, some particles are rod-shaped, and be able to determine how sensitive each one of these types of particles was to their chemical environment. Okay. And so this one, so the crux of this study is that if you have a spherical particle and you're monitoring change in refractive index, it too can sense a shift. Okay. But if you follow the lines here, right, there's a more or less a linear relationship between the dielectric of the environment that the particle is in versus the amount of the shift that you can get here. This is the change in the plasma resonance. And you can see that the slope of the spherical particle is less than that of the triangular particle. And that is less than that of the rod-shaped particle. So the more anisotropic you can make a particle, the greater a shift that you can get in the refractive index. Okay. And so in fact, this RIU term stands for refractive index unit. Okay. So if one were to make a very long skinny shaped rod, you can further increase the slope that can lead to larger shifts. Okay. And now there are ways to actually push beyond even a couple hundred nanometers. Now people have found there's a way to push into the several thousand nanometers per RI unit by coupling anisotropic particles together. So there again is yet another dimension to how we can change surface plasma resonance characteristics. Okay. But again, you know, nanostructured metal substrates, right, have this just enormous sensitivity to changes in their local chemical environment, right? And so now what we realize here is that changing the shape of the particle is an important parameter for doing this. Okay. So why is that? Okay. Why is that? We haven't talked anything about changes in shape yet. Okay. So rather than going back to physical equations, I think we're going to talk about this just in terms of experimental parameters. And what people have agreed is the basic principles behind this. Okay. And so I'm going to use as our case study for this gold nanorods. This is actually the easiest case to understand. Okay. So think of a gold nanorod as a sphere that's been stretched out. Okay. And you can keep stretching the gold nanorod. Right? It certainly can do this on a computer, and you can see changes in their optical properties. Okay? So what happens is as you introduce some kind of anisotropy into a metal structure, is that you are reducing symmetry and you're introducing additional modes. Okay? So in the case of a gold rod, we tend to think of this as not one plasmon resonance, but two resonances. Okay? So one resonance is going to be associated with what we call the transverse mode, right? Going across the midsection. The other one, which is the one that's sensitive to the anisotropy, is along the long axis. This is the longitudinal plasmon resonance. Okay, and so here, right, is some very famous data taken just before the turn of the millennium, and what they were able to do was to isolate out gold nanorods of different length to width ratios. Okay, and this is what we simply call an aspect ratio. So if we take gold rods of different aspect ratios, starting from say 2.5 to 3.5 to 4 to longer, right? What you can see is this very gradual shift in the plasma's resonance position, right? As you increase the length-to-width ratio, you're able to shift the longitudinal plasmon from say the visible range, right, which starts at around 600 or 650 in this case, right? And now you're actually extending it past the visible range into the near infrared. Okay. If you were to continue to increase this, as has already been done by several people, you can shift this into the mid-IR range and even further. So there actually is no limit to where you can push the plasma resonance based on this distinction of longitudinal versus transverse modes. It was thought at the time that such studies were done that there's some kind of linear relationship between the wavelength of excitation, the wavelength of resonance, and the aspect ratio. That's not strictly true. It's not really a linear relationship. For this range here, just a few data points, you can plot a line, but actually if you extend this out further, it doesn't continue to be linear. But qualitatively, it's true. If the longer you make the rod, right, the higher the aspect ratio, the more this is going to shift into longer and longer wavelengths. Okay, so that's probably all that's important. Now, this gives rise to another factor why gold particles and metal particles have become so strongly favored by many people in the community. And so as you start to get outside the visible range and into near infrared, you start to reach a certain capability that's not widely available with other types of materials. Okay, and so it turns out that there are relatively few materials that absorb or scatter light well in the near-infrared range. Okay, and this turns out to be a very nice range with which to couple to biological systems, living systems. Okay, and so the reason for that simply is that if you were to shine light through, say, biological tissue, that most of the light in the visible range would be blocked because you have pigments and hemoglobin and other things that absorb the visible range. Okay, and if you're to use mid-infrared range, right, then most of that also gets blocked because it's absorbed by water and, of course, your lipids and those sort of things. But there's this window of relatively high transmissivity, right, between 750 nanometers and 1.3 microns, 1300 nanometers, that allows light to pass through. It's not completely transparent, certainly, right? You can see that there's absorption here, but it's relatively transparent compared to the visible versus the mid-infrared. So the near-infrared is this window of opportunity that you can pass light into tissue deeper, more deeply than you can from either side of that spectrum. Okay, and so metal particles is one of the several nanomaterials that has a very strong extinction or scattering properties in this what's often termed the biological window. Okay, so I think we might talk about that next week, but depending on how fast we go, I can show you a couple of examples of that later. Okay, well, I promise not to talk about synthesis so much, but I only want to talk about this in the context of how the aspect ratio changes according to optical property changes according to aspect ratio. So in the case of gold nanorods, it turns out that the way that you make them is that you start with small, relatively spherical gold seeds, and you grow them in a micellar mixture. Okay, and the details are important, but I'm just going to simply say that there are now well-established conditions that you can just control the length of these rods and get a very high yield of rods with quite uniform aspect ratios, right? So in this case, this is close to 3.5 to 1, right, in terms of the ratio. So this puts it in the near-infrared range over here. But notice that the shape of the rod is not perfectly cylindrical, right? That in fact, in this case, the rod shape is a little bit wider at the ends than it is in the middle. Okay, and this is, this has to do with the kinetics of the synthesis. But I just want you to look at this image versus this one here. Okay, so this is a freshly prepared sample of gold nanorods, and this is a sample that's been sitting around for a couple of days, and so there are. What's happened in this case is that there's additional gold left in solution that deposits in the middle, and now these take on a more of a cylindrical shape. And this dark spectrum is the longitudinal resonance for this guy, and this one, the dashed line, is the resonance for this one here. And there's a very subtle change in the shape, right? But this has to do with the fact not that the gold nanorods continue to grow shorter the gold nanorods are about the same length in each case, but the ratio of the length versus the width here is less than the length versus width here. So even though it's actually a very subtle change in shape, right, it's certainly enough to affect the plasma resonance by almost 100 nanometers in this case. Okay, so the structure of these metal particles certainly plays a huge role on exactly the positions that they are. So we can calculate, we can simulate them, but when it comes to actually preparing them, there's lots of additional little tidbits in terms of the positions for these. Okay, for us, we can just assume we can take the simplest track, right? We'll just simply assume that length versus width is a fixed ratio, so we can dial in, right, the ratio we need for the wavelength of interest. Okay, and so there are legions of anisotropic particles out there, all of which have their own story to tell in terms of, right, how their shape affects their optical properties. Okay, so again, size is just as important as shape, but there's really all different kind of geometries that can be incorporated that can be modulating these colors. So let me go back to the triangular particles, the prism. So here's this colloid lithography, as it's called, right? So again, if you evaporate gold on top of a monolayer of silica particles or latex particles, you'll end up with these triangular shaped particles down here. And so what you can see here is that depending on the rate of evaporation and the size of their template, right, you can get three different resonances according to just, again, relatively subtle changes in structure, right? So if you had a purely triangular particle like this, you get the longest wavelength. But if you truncate the corners off, then you get intermediate type of resonances here. Okay, so another example about how shape is really minor changes in shape really influence the optical properties. Okay, this is another famous structure. I won't go into too much detail about it, but this is there's a concentric anisotropy, right? This is a shell of gold around a dielectric core, and this also resonates in the near infrared. Unlike the others, though, these are relatively sharp peaks, at least as far as plasma is concerned. This one can absorb and scatter light in near infrared, but it's much broader. Okay, but still, it has a lot of very beneficial features for biological applications. This has been very interesting. They found that if you control the growth conditions of gold particles, that you can get different polyhedral shapes. So it's found that if you start with the right structure seed, you can actually get something that contains these what's called a pentatwin defect, and you'll get a C5 symmetric particle, right? And so this is actually a decahedron. You got five faces on one side, and of course you have five on the other. And if you tilt the particle, right, about 90 degrees, you can see it has a sort of a diamond shape cross-section here. And this too, of course, is anisotropic. It's more like a disc as opposed to a rod, but a disc-like shape also, right, follows the same sort of rule, right? The longer or the wider the particle is and the narrower the gap is, you can also shift its plasma resonance further to the longer wavelengths. Okay, there are more examples here. These are cube-shaped particles, there's these star-shaped particles. All of them can produce resonance that shift to longer wavelengths if you just simply introduce in more anisotropy. Okay, so, and I'm sure there are more examples to come in the next few years, but right, there's just a kind of a representation of all different shapes. Yes?
Do certain shapes last longer than nighttimes and others?
I'm sorry, say it again.
Do certain shapes like last longer than others?
Okay, that's an excellent question. So if you take something that's really long and rod-like or sharp-tipped like this, right, maybe it doesn't last long, and that's actually very true. So eventually, thermodynamics takes over, and so a lot of these are under strain, lattice strain, and so as a material, they're not the most stable, and so if they're in conditions which can... which are considered corrosive, then the particles can reshape, and eventually we'll get to more of a spherical structure. So that's one of the reasons that this is advantageous, is that you can also tune its optical property. Maybe it's not as nice as some of these, but it doesn't change its shape because it's already spherical. So it's a good example. Okay, but you know, nano rods actually turn out to be quite stable. They're not only they're easy to make that. But as long as you keep them under relatively controlled conditions, they will retain their shape without too much problem. And the anisotropy of gold rods has really been the favorite for most people who are interested in seeing these kind of shifts. So you wouldn't be too surprised to hear then, right, that since the triangular particles cause some shifts, that the nanorods would be even stronger in terms of the shifts that they have. And if you can put molecules at the ends of the gold nanorod, then those shifts are the strongest of all, because of course that is in line with the longitudinal resonance, right? So if you put molecules on the surfaces here, or they happen to be there, then that doesn't influence the plasma resonance as much as if you have interactions at the ends. Okay? And it's a very interesting coincidence that gold nanorods, because of the way that the ends are shaped, the rate at which molecules can exchange at the ends, especially on the facets and the vertices, is faster than exchanging in the middle. So in fact, the most reactive, chemically reactive portions of the rods are actually the tips. So it's kind of a favorable coincidence for those who are interested to use the optical properties of gold rods, that they can actually by controlling the chemistry, deposit on average more proteins or other kind of recognition elements at the tips of the gold rod. So here's an example. This actually was from Purdue, it's Joseph Iradiyaraj in the agricultural biological engineering. And so what he showed here is that he could make three different shaped gold rods, right, with three different resonances. If you just follow the red peaks here, here, and here. And because of their positions and because of the sharpness of the peaks, he was able to put three gold rods with three different kind of proteins, antibodies. And so when he has one antibody and its antigen binding, you can see this change in the resonance. It's about a shift about 20 nanometers. And when he uses the second one shifts. And then the third one, right, then that one independently shifts too. So this is an example of multiplexing where, right, when you have materials that that are more or less orthogonal to each other, right, you can actually use this to detect multiple kinds of analytes without having to worry about interference between these. So one of the quests of by this person as well as many others is, can you screen a complex solution of analytes, right? If you're looking for several kinds of molecules, or you know you have several kinds of molecules, you want to fish out one, right? Can you have a system that basically can pick out just that one, right? Or pick out some other in their different conditions, okay? So again, things like gold nanorods are favorable for doing things like this, okay? Second example, very similar, but this is again this decahedron, right? Looking at it from the side. And so this one has an even stronger sensitivity. So now we're starting to talk about things that are, getting close to 400 RIU per nanometer. This should be reversed. And so they're using this fixed on surfaces, just like we did with the triangular particles, right? You could see shifts in the wavelength, right? And so here they're able to do real-time measurements, just changes in concentration, less of a nanomolar. You're able to see, you start to see some jumps here. And as you increase the concentration, then you can, of course, get a correspondingly large shift in the plasma peaks. Okay, so these kind of games are being played all the time now because our ability to make these particles is actually very well defined. Okay, I think because of the change in topics, I'm going to break early for today. So next Tuesday, I'm going to start and talk about what happens when you bring particles closer to each other. This is this really brings us to the next level. So I think what would be best is to allow us to focus on, our relatively simple system of single particles, and also give you some time to work on your project. Okay. So after spring break, we'll start talking about nanoparticles again, but of a more complex nature.